From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Our system of government requires people to have a basic understanding of how it works. That's why two members of the North Carolina Supreme Court are leading a statewide campaign promoting civics education. State lawmakers will push again this year to raise the age for juvenile criminal offenders. You'll hear highlights from a recent debate about the topic. Familiar faces will lead the North Carolina House and Senate again this year. You'll hear the top priorities of House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger. Plus, you'll learn why taxpayers should pay attention to bids in both Charlotte and Raleigh to land a Major League Soccer franchise. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
School choice advocates from across the country have spent the last week touting the benefits of empowering parents by giving them choices in how and where their kids can be educated. The John Locke Foundation, of course, has championed choice for decades and, in fact, has helped North Carolina become a leader in the choice movement. And now, growth projections from the state's largest public school district illustrates just how much parents really like being able to choose. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Research and Education Studies. He joins us now to talk about some of the newest data. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
This is fascinating what's going on in Wake County. Now, for the second year in a row, they have lowered their long-term enrollment projections. But people are moving into Wake County. So what gives with that?
Well, they're moving into Wake County, and they're taking advantage of the many options that Wake County provides, especially charter schools. And this has been an ongoing issue with Wake County, our state's largest school district, because it had been growing so fast, and they've had to spend millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in building new facilities. So their enrollment projections are important for determining whether voters have to decide on whether to approve more debt for school facilities and whether they have to go on aggressive recruiting trips for teachers, especially from other states, to find teachers to come into the system. So the fact that they have actually estimated down means that taxpayers are not going to be hit with more taxes to build more buildings, and that the school district will be better able to manage its personnel in the system.
Taxpayers then are going to be getting some relief, and parents are getting more choices. Sounds like one of those classic win-win situations. That's the way you see it, but does everybody see it that way?
Oh, absolutely not. The school system, the school board, advocacy groups, of course, see this as a terrible thing, that parents have all these choices and are not choosing the traditional district system. They believe that all students should go to the district system for various reasons. Some believe because they believe it to be a superior education. Some people believe that it's a matter of the common good, or there's some sort of thing that brings us together by going to the traditional district system. But the reality is that parents aren't necessarily thinking about those things. Parents are thinking about their children, and they're thinking about what's best for their children. And increasingly, they're finding that what's best for their children is not attending a school system that has over 150,000 students and over 10,000 teachers, but rather it's a charter school where it's a tight-knit community. It's typically less than 1,000 students, typically smaller faculty, smaller class sizes. This is what parents want when it comes to the charter schools, and increasingly more homeschooling, which has the smallest class sizes and the smallest teacher-to-student ratio. And this is these are the kind of choices that North Carolina is giving to parents, and more the kind of choices that they're increasingly taking advantage of.
Terry, people who support giving parents more opportunities, more choices to decide for themselves are typically cast as somehow anti-public school. But isn't it possible to believe that everyone should just be able to choose what's best for them and not be anti-public school?
Yeah, this is really unfortunate, and this is something that I talk about a lot when I talk about school choices. The parents that opt out of school, of a traditional district school, don't do so because they're mad at the district system or that they're mad at the parents that send their kids to the district system. There's no malice there. There's no anger there. Rather, they are simply exercising a choice that I think a lot more parents wish they had and unfortunately don't. So if you talk to any parent that exercises that choice, I don't think you'll find very many at all that say that the reason why they left is because the traditional system is somehow doing destructive things. They're simply saying that, you know, my child has unique needs. I had something completely different in mind when it came to my child's education, and that's why I chose to go a different route.
Not to mention that charter schools are part of the public system. So in that case, they're not even opting out of the public system in their county. I thought it was interesting that in the stories that have been written about Wake County for the second year now, lowering those enrollment growth projections, one of the officials on the Wake County Commission made a comment that they're happy to compete. The mere fact that they're thinking in terms of competition, a good thing for quality?
An excellent thing for quality. And you know, for so many years, it wasn't that they were competing with charter schools. It's that the charter schools were just taking their money, and there was really no competition. They're just taking their money and wasting it. But now they're seeing something else, that charter schools are providing a high-quality academic and education for the children that attend. And that as it gets better and better, that the kids that are in the district system start to see, well, wait a second, you know, these charter schools are actually giving a better education with other advantages, such as proximity to their home or the fact that they're not in a system of 150,000 kids, which could be overwhelming to a lot of parents, especially parents that move into the county and they're used to having small school districts where they come from, and suddenly they're in a countywide district with over 150,000 kids. It could be extremely overwhelming. That fact alone would be sufficient for a parent to find out, seek out a charter school option for their children.
Let's talk a little bit more about charters. Roughly how many of them are there in North Carolina, and are they spread out across the state?
We're approaching 170 charter schools in North Carolina, and we're getting close, but not quite, at 100,000 students attending charter schools, which is double the students we had just 5 years ago. They have become more spread out, although they are concentrated in urban and suburban counties for now. Sometimes a startup in a charter school in a rural community can be difficult, but we're finding more and more that charter schools are thriving in those areas. So as the number of charter schools grows, thanks to the work of the General Assembly, former Governor Pat McCrory were key in making sure that the charter school sector expand in North Carolina, we're finding that there's more opportunities for students regardless of where they live in North Carolina, and not just for those in Wake, Mecklenburg, or the surrounding counties.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned homeschooling. That seems to be growing by leaps and bounds as well. And there was a time when people equated homeschools with religious education, but not so much anymore.
No, definitely not so much anymore. Homeschools are the mainstream. We've seen approximately a doubling of homeschools in the last 7 or 8 years. Homeschooling has become much easier with the internet and access to materials. But not only that, the General Assembly made sure that homeschoolers have more allowances when it comes to participating in group activities. So homeschooling has become much more popular, much easier, and much more of a community than I think a lot of people envision what homeschooling is. It's not just kids sitting at home all day. It's kids sitting at home most of the day and then participating with activities with their peers outside of the home for the remainder.
Terry, what option seems to really have the wind at its sails, so to speak? Is it charters? Is it homeschools? What's really growing?
Really, charters and homeschools are the two sectors that are growing by leaps and bounds. Private schooling, not so much. The Great Recession, of course, had a lot to do with the fact that paying for a private school was difficult for a lot of families. So private school is not growing as quickly, although with our private school voucher programs, we're seeing some growth in the private school sector. But homeschooling, of course, has the largest segment of well over 115,000 students. But we're going to see homeschooling and charter schooling continue to grow, and the district system will continue to grow as well, but not as fast as those two.
And all of this data, of course, is why the John Locke Foundation this week participated in National School Choice Week. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Locke Foundation's Director of Research and Education Studies. You can read all of his work at johnlocke.org. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina lawmakers head back to Raleigh. There's a new governor in town. Working together or working against each other, they'll make big decisions. Decisions that affect you, your wallet, your home, your business, your kids' education. To keep up with those big decisions, day by day, even minute by minute, look to Carolina Journal, a full team of reporters and analysts. They're watching the action in the state capitol. They're reporting minute by minute developments for you. Carolina Journal. It's available each month as a free newspaper and every day with updated stories at carolinajournal.com. You'll find us on Facebook, too. Share items from Carolina Journal. Share items from the John Locke Foundation. Follow us on Twitter, at Carolina Journal, at John Locke NC, and at Becky Gray. Carolina Journal, it's your go-to source for news about state government and how government affects your life. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. In order for our system of government to work well, people need some basic understanding of how that system works. That's the idea behind civics education. And our next guests are devoting some of their already busy schedules to the topic of civics education. The Honorable Sam Irvin IV and the Honorable Paul Newby are Associate Justices on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having
me with you.
So I understand that in addition to just a general interest in civics education, you're working on this as part of a project that was set up by Chief Justice Mark Martin. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, since 1776, our state constitution has emphasized that a frequent recurrence of fundamental principles absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. Chief Justice Martin, in recognition of that and also the challenges that we see across our state, with regard to a lack of civic education, has encouraged Justice Irvin and myself to be proactive in this area.
Justice Irvin, why is this so important?
Well, I think you alluded to it in your opening remarks. Obviously, as a Democratic or Republican or however you want to describe it, form
small
of government,
D and small R.
Exactly. The validity or workability of that system depends on the existence of an educated citizenry. And so to the extent that the citizens of the state don't have the information about the way the government works to function in that type of government accordingly, we're all at risk. And so what we're trying to do is to do what we can to make sure that the citizens understand how the government works, with a particular emphasis on the role that the judiciary plays in our form of government.
So we know that this education is important, including the role of the judiciary. What are you all doing to help people learn about it?
Well, the good news is this emphasis coincides with a whole bunch of anniversaries of our court. We have the 50th anniversary of the consolidated court system, where we have the district courts as opposed to what used to be justice of the peace or city courts, municipal courts, that type of thing. We have the 50th anniversary of the Court of Appeals, the 240th anniversary of the Superior Court, which is our court that we've had since our founding in 1776. And then we have the Supreme Court looking at its 200th anniversary in the years 2018 and 2019.
And in addition to that, that's being done by a broader committee across different branches of the court system. Justice Newby and I are also, I think it's fair to say, primarily responsible for the creation and administration of the Speaker's Bureau, where we have arranged for, I think the number is approximately 300 different folks who volunteer to do this, to go across the state, speak to school groups, church groups, civic groups, anybody that will listen to us about this topic.
We are chatting with two members of the North Carolina Supreme Court, the Honorable Sam Irvin IV and the Honorable Paul Newby, Associate Justices on that court. Obviously, you all are busy looking at cases, hearing arguments, going through many legal documents. Why is it so important to be devoting time and attention to this project, too?
Well, we certainly care about the future of our state, and it is vital that people understand the significance of appreciating the kind of system that we have. For 99% of the history of the world, people believe that those in power defined rights, and yet we have a system that says that all are created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson said we need a revolution every 20 years to help people step back and go, wow, how should we govern ourselves? So this is important.
And I think one of the reasons that we're doing this is to emphasize the role of the judiciary. I believe Paul would agree with me when I say this, is when we go out and speak to people about government, the judicial branch is probably the least understood branch, and there are folks who range from a belief that it has no power to a belief that it has unlimited power and that we can do whatever we want to. Neither is true. And so as part of this, it's important to understand what role the judicial branch actually plays. Let's say that three times and see how well we do it. What role the judicial branch plays, what its authority is, what the limitations on its authority are, how the people who participate in that system view its role, because that in many ways is the least understood part of our system of government. And that's one reason that we're emphasizing that.
You led into something that I was going to bring up. When you're out talking to people and they know that you're on the Supreme Court, do you get a general sense that people know what the Supreme Court or the courts in general do, or do they have sort of a skewed sense of it?
Well, the most frequently asked question I get is, oh, you're just on the Supreme Court. Can you help me with my speeding ticket? So generally speaking, you know, and the good news is most people have not encountered the judicial system. The bad news is most folks don't understand the judicial system.
And I think that's fair. I mean, I haven't for some reason gotten asked about the speeding tickets. Maybe there's a perception that Justice Newby's better at that line of work than I am. But I do think that there are lots of, I mean, there are many questions about, you know, why are you elected? Why don't you do this, that, or the other? Why won't you talk to me about this particular kind of case, just like my legislator will? I don't think, For perfectly good reasons, many citizens really understand how the courts function and what their role in the system is. And to the extent that we can do something to alleviate that deficit in public education, it would be a good thing.
I insert something? Just as folks are listening to this, if you want a speaker, you want a judge, you want a lawyer to come talk about our state constitution, federal constitution, any aspect of this, visit celebratenccourts.org, celebratenccourts.org, and you can pick and choose from that list what speaker you would like to come to your group.
And I haven't checked this precisely, but I did a count of the number of people who had signed up for it, and I think there are people willing to do this that live in somewhere around 90 of the 100 counties in the state, and then a number of us, including the two of us, have agreed to the extent that our schedule will permit to go anywhere in the state. So you and the people that are participants in it include not just the two of us, but other superior and district court judges, court of appeals judges, trial court administrators, lawyers, interested citizens. It's a wide range of people, and so you can almost get the kind of speaker you want up to a certain degree of flexibility.
Well, it's good to know that those options are available. A lot of people pay attention to the governor, what he or she does. Also, the General Assembly gets in the news a lot. We don't hear a whole heck of a lot about the courts other than criminal trials, certainly not the appellate courts. We don't hear much about them. Why is it so important that people know what the courts do and their role in our overall system?
Well, I think it's since 1868, we've been electing judges. So it's incumbent upon people to understand the role as they seek to elect and reelect justices. Justice Bob Edmunds or others that are on the ballot this time need people to fully understand the role that we play. We're not legislators in black robes. If you see a judge on the front page of a paper, it's kind of like seeing a referee on the front page of the sports section. Something went wrong. So it's a good thing when we are under the radar screen simply doing our job.
I mean, I think that's fair. And I do think there is a sense in a number of different segments of the society that judges have some kind of ex cathedra, let's do what we think we ought to do regardless of what the law is, that kind of mentality is out there. And to the extent that we can explain what we can and can't do and get the public to understand that, I think the level of public confidence in the judiciary will increase. And that is important because in a society that operates off the rule of law, the rule of law is only as effective as it is the degree of citizen support for it is.
Well, it's certainly an important topic, and if you'd like to learn more, once again, that website?
The website is celebratenccourts.org.
All right. We thank the Honorable Sam Ervin IV and the voice you just heard, the Honorable Paul Newby, Associate Justices on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at carolinajournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers are pushing once again to treat 16- and 17-year-old criminal offenders as juveniles. Democratic Representative Dwayne Hall of Wake County recently reminded colleagues of the potential benefits.
The big one is recidivist rates. They're far, far lower in juvenile systems. Diversion programs in the juvenile systems reduce crime. And one of the objections to the bills I had was obviously cost, but all the studies, all the other states have shown that juvenile systems save states literally tens of millions of dollars, or it should for the state of North Carolina. Safety of the children is another major concern. Children are far more likely to get raped when they are held in adult prisons, 36 times more likely to commit suicides when they're held in adult prisons. And a lot of it's fairness to our children, even for the smallest misdemeanors that they are convicted of. When that's something, an adult record that sticks with them for the rest of their lives, when they have to compete against children in South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, who may have made the exact same type of youthful mistake, but because those states treat theirs as juveniles, they don't have that permanent record when they have to compete for college and jobs for the rest of their lives.
Hall says groups across the political spectrum support the change.
American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, conservatives for criminal justice reform, Council for Children's Rights, Disability Rights, the Locke Foundation, NC Child, North Carolina Division of Adult Correction Juvenile Justice, the North Carolina Magistrates Association, North Carolina Police Benevolent Association, North Carolina Sentencing and Policy Advisory Commission, and the North Carolina Sheriff's Association.
But District Attorney Wallace Bradshaw of Caswell and Person Counties raised an objection.
I agree with all of the goals of raising the juvenile age. Giving young people a record, I'm not for. I believe in creating a redemptive process. However, over those 20 years, I saw a lot of times a break was just a break. It wasn't transformative. My concern about just raising the age, that arbitrary 16 and 17-year-olds. So we have people come in our courts that are truly kids who made one youthful mistake who would be great in juvenile court. We also have 16 and 17-year-olds who are men, who are hardened gang members, who are drug dealers, who are violent, who don't work well. Putting them with 14 and 15-year-olds in the same courtroom, in the same system, would be negative for all those other young people that we're trying to save.
Raising the age of the juvenile justice system would require support from the full state House and Senate. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Familiar faces are leading both the North Carolina Senate and the House of Representatives this year. Senators reelected Republican Phil Berger of Rockingham County to his fourth term as Senate leader. After the vote, Berger reminded colleagues of the situation lawmakers faced when he first took the job.
Just 6 short years ago, our state faced a double-digit unemployment rate, fifth highest in the entire country. Now, due in large part to difficult decisions made by the legislature, our unemployment rate has fallen in half, and North Carolina is creating jobs faster than other states. North Carolina once struggled with stagnant job growth, declining family incomes. Now a thriving economy has generated more than 450,000 new jobs. The number of working North Carolinians has soared to historic highs. And median household income in North Carolina has jumped by close to $10,000 per household. Our state and its private sector economic engine was once burdened with the highest taxes in the Southeast and one of the worst tax climates in the nation. Now, as a result of our nationally recognized tax cuts and tax reform, North Carolina businesses and citizens pay billions of dollars less in taxes. Our state now boasts the best tax climate in the region and the 11th best tax climate in the nation. But there is still more work to be done. We were once weighed down by record budget deficits and billions of dollars in debt to the federal government. Now, balanced budgets and controlled spending, along with a growing economy, have yielded consecutive years of budget surpluses. Our debt to the federal government has been paid in full.
Berger also reminded colleagues of recent gains in public education.
Public schools were once struggling with declining state support. Thousands of state-funded teachers' positions were eliminated. Teachers were furloughed, and their pay was frozen. Now, state funding for our public schools has reached record levels. New teachers have been hired, and average teacher pay has climbed above $50,000 for the first time in state history. When we assumed the majority in January of 2011, our state's rainy day fund was depleted. Now, as we saw with the swift response to recent natural disasters, we are well prepared for emergencies and downturns, with more than $1.5 billion in the state's savings reserve. There's no question that due to hard work and perseverance of public servants in this building and their supportive families, our state has made a dramatic turnaround. It's working toward the kinds of positive change that help make North Carolina the best state to build a business and the best state to live and raise a family.
Senate Leader Phil Berger contrasted the General Assembly's recent accomplishments with the types of stories that generate negative headlines.
Perhaps there's no better example of the problems we can solve when we work together than the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. What many don't realize is that the lion's share of what we work on in these halls is not controversial. Most laws pass with overwhelming bipartisan support. No matter what our political party, we're all here because we want to help our state thrive and for our citizens to reach their full potential. It's disheartening that some only want to focus on what divides us, what draws in the most campaign contributions, what attracts the most free press attention, what is sensational enough to sell the most newspapers and television advertisements. Members, as we consider the task ahead at the start of this session, let us remember all that we can accomplish when we work together. And let us remember that all that can be achieved as we continue down this new path for our state and labor to fulfill the promises we made to our constituents.
So what lies ahead for the state Senate over the next 2 years?
In the coming session, we'll maintain the budgeting and spending discipline and the commitment to pro-growth tax policies that have helped return our state to good fiscal health. Let me be clear. We will not, under any circumstances, return to the failed tax and spend policies of the past that gave us the mess that we had in 2011. We'll continue to look for ways to reduce the tax burden on families, small businesses, and other job creators, helping them keep more of their own money. We'll continue efforts to reform and improve public education for our students and have already committed to raising average teacher pay to $55,000 over the next 2 years. We'll remain focused on providing a bright future for our children and helping build a capable workforce that will attract business to the state. We'll do even more to simplify outdated job-killing rules and regulations and foster a better business climate with the goal of sustaining North Carolina's strong job growth. And we'll continue building state reserves to make sure that North Carolina is well prepared for the future.
Across the hall in the state legislative building, the North Carolina House of Representatives elected Republican Tim Moore of Cleveland County to a second term as House Speaker.
You know, it seems to me that North Carolina has always existed with a little rivalry, and yes, even some division. But in the end, there's always much more that unites us. There are rivalries east and west, different basketball teams, competing NASCAR drivers, political parties, you know what, and even different types of barbecue. But in the end, we are all North Carolinians. In the end, we have goals for our state that are much more alike than they are different. We want job creation and growth. There are so many things that make our state attractive to new businesses and relocating businesses. We certainly need to continue to make necessary reforms to continue producing even more jobs. Citizens in the private sector are driving investments that have put more people to work and grown our tax base. To keep growing, we must maintain our commitments to tax reform and relief, pass balanced budgets, and cultivate a workforce that is career-ready and educated in an increasingly innovative world.
Moore described his goals for helping the state's economy.
It is critical that North Carolina continue to develop a diverse economy to attract investment and remain competitive. It's my priority to work with each one of you to make North Carolina the most competitive and prosperous state economy in the nation. Further, our state needs a dynamic education system that serves students with the tools they need to lead North Carolina into the next decade. We must work together to help our students achieve our school systems, community colleges, universities, charter schools, succeed at every level in a new era for education in North Carolina. And thanks to our commitment to the hardworking educators, first-year teachers in North Carolina will at long last make at least $35,000 a year. And we continue to work to bring the average teacher pay up around the state. And we made great strides these past 2 years.
House Speaker Tim Moore reminded colleagues of the importance of sound government budgeting practices.
We have a duty to conduct our government in the responsible and prudent manner in which families and businesses manage their own finances. Plan for unseen events and prepare for times of need. In this last budget, we had a rainy day fund. Aren't we glad we had a rainy day fund with what happened this fall with the floods that ravaged eastern North Carolina? Members, we will soon face important decisions that affect the financial security of the public, decisions that will influence the future of our state. Issues requiring us to weigh choices that impact the economic vitality of our great state and the protection of our citizens will come before us. I pledge to you, members and citizens of North Carolina, we will make those decisions together in good faith with the priorities of our people put first.
That's Republican State Representative Tim Moore, recently elected to a second term as North Carolina House Speaker. You also heard from re-elected Senate Leader Phil Berger. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Could North Carolina soon become home to a Major League Soccer franchise? Our next guest advises all of us to follow closely the news that Charlotte and Raleigh are indeed vying for a team. Why? Well, because it could come at a price tag for each and every one of us. Julie Tisdale is the City and County Policy Analyst for the John Locke Foundation. She joins me now. Welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
So we know that Major League Soccer is growing all over the country, and the world is really in love with soccer. North Carolina's population is growing rapidly, so it seems like there could be a nexus here.
There could be. Soccer is very, very popular. Kids are playing soccer. I live very close to a YMCA, and Saturday mornings it is just full of kids playing soccer. The Carolina Railhawks, now North Carolina FC, have been very successful. So it is certainly... it's certainly growing, and it could be ripe for a Major League Soccer franchise. That's possible.
You've been writing about this, and it appears that we now have two areas of the state, kind of two groups of people, apparently, who are interested in maybe bringing a team to North Carolina. Tell us about the proposals.
That's true. So the first is that one in Raleigh-Durham, the Carolina Railhawks, now North Carolina FC. They've changed their name. They're looking to become a Major League Soccer franchise. They're a pretty well-established organization, and they've got an owners group that actually is prepared to put in a pretty good amount of money. They're submitting that proposal to MLS. The other is Charlotte, which announced a few weeks after the North Carolina FC group that they would also like to get a Major League Soccer franchise. That's kind of being headed up by Bruton Smith, who own the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And he's looking for a partnership with the city and the county to build a stadium and bring the team there.
Do we know anything about whether or not either of those two groups have in their proposal some sort of public money that they are requesting?
We do know a little bit. The proposals are due to Major League Soccer at the end of the month, so there's still a lot that's in the works. We don't know all the details yet. What we do know is that Charlotte City Council met a couple of weeks ago in a closed session. We don't know exactly what happened there, but we do know that Bruton Smith's asking for $50 million from the city, $50 million from the county, and then he would put in another $50 million himself to build the stadium. So that's just the stadium cost, which would be $150 million. In Raleigh, Steve Malik, who owns North Carolina FC, has said that he and his sort of ownership group is willing to put up the money themselves for a stadium, but there might also need to be some help from the city or the county for things like parking or some infrastructure, and the details aren't quite clear on that.
Now, as you've been writing about this and looking at those details, which one do you think is a better deal for taxpayers?
The proposal that uses the least taxpayer money is the better deal, I think, for taxpayers. This is a very expensive undertaking. We're just talking about stadium costs right now, but there's a $150 million fee for joining the league
as well.
And then we get into the costs of actually running the team and hiring players and staff and, you know, I mean, all of that. So this is a lot of money we're talking about. If we've got wealthy businessmen, investors who want to put money there and think that they can make money out of a franchise, I think that's great. Go for it. They should do that. But a proposal like Charlotte's that's talking about a lot of public money up front just to get the stadium built really concerns me. That puts taxpayers on the hook for it, and it's if we're needing to go to the government for money, that presumably means it's a venture that private investors don't feel good about. Perhaps we ought to take that as a warning about the sort of wisdom of that investment for taxpayers as well.
Do we have any history, any examples, either within the league or perhaps in other sports, about what may occur if a package is put together and taxpayers are part of it?
There have been lots of varying experiences. In some places, it's kind of okay. It's not a disaster. It works all right. But in some places, it's been terrible. And probably the worst is the Chicago Fire. They have a stadium in a little suburb of Chicago, not far from the city at all. It was built with 100% public money, and it has been an absolute disaster. They lose $3 to $4 million every year. They've seen their credit ratings drop. The little village has, city, whatever it is. They've seen tax rates go up to pay for this $3 to $4 million sort of black hole that is this team. The team hasn't been very successful. They haven't been able to attract businesses to the area. When they first launched, they said all the same things that we typically hear about these sorts of ventures. This will trigger all kinds of economic development and other businesses will come. That just hasn't materialized. There's evidently one gas station and that's it. There's nothing else near the stadium. So it clearly has not been the beginning of a lot of economic development for the area. It's been exactly the opposite.
I think common sense, Julie, tells us that no investor, whether they're doing it completely with their own money or a group of investors' money, or whether it's a group that has some private money and public money, they don't want to go into something thinking that it's going to be a bad deal. You know, who would want to do that? But they tend to rely on these studies that are always very optimistic about what is going to occur. And since we've seen this a number of times, it makes you kind of wonder why they aren't scrutinizing these impact studies more before they make these massive commitments.
It does make you wonder that. I've asked that question a lot. I think the idea of having professional sports is kind of appealing. I think to a certain extent, cities kind of hear what they want to hear. So the idea of having the sports team is exciting. I think also cities are looking for something. They want economic development, and they're not sure what their options are. So somebody presents this shiny proposal, and that can be it can be pretty convincing. And there are examples where it's okay. You know, they can kind of show the example where sales have gone, ticket sales have been high, and there's been some development around the stadium. And there, sometimes that sort of works. Now, I'm not sure that they really make back the hundreds of millions of dollars that they put in, but you can see successful franchises. And so I think that that's very appealing. And certainly for someone like Bruton Smith, who is putting in $50 million, if he can get the city to put in – the city to put in $50 million and the county to put in $50 million, that lowers his risk. That's really appealing. So he's got all kinds of incentive to try to get the city on board.
And that argument right there is kind of an appealing one to some mm-hmm. people, because it can be presented as this is a partnership. We're
Absolutely.
All in this together. And, yes, there's private money, so we're not trying to take you taxpayers or anything like that. So there might be people who think that doesn't sound like a very bad idea.
It's a partnership, but the major beneficiary, if this takes off, is going to be Bruton Smith, not me. So I think he can put up his money for it if he wants to, but I'm not sure we want to ask all taxpayers, including people who really are struggling, you know, parents who are trying to feed their kids, people that don't make a ton of money but own a house and pay some property taxes, or are renting and are paying higher rents to pay for the property owner's property taxes. I mean, this affects everybody. So I think that we really want to be careful about spending lots and lots of taxpayer money on a venture that may or may not benefit the community.
Now, you mentioned that the proposals are due any time now, so mm-hmm. I take it you're going to be taking a look pretty closely at these.
I am. We're going to be looking at those proposals, and we're going to be doing some more work on this issue. We should have a report coming out late in February looking at this in more detail.
We'll have you back to talk about all the details on that. We've been talking with Julie Tisdale. She is the City and County Policy Analyst for the John Locke Foundation. And if you'd like to read this current report that we're talking about, you can find her research brief at johnlocke.org. Again, her name is Julie Tisdale. Julie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. I hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.